One, two, three, four.
Hello and welcome to episode 12 of the Behind the Curtain Ministry podcast. We are recording today from Libertyville, Illinois, and I will embarrass my interview guest here a little bit. She is one of my newfound faith heroes, and God has used her in amazing ways in my life, and I'm super excited here in a moment to introduce you to Ruth Haley Barton. Before I do that, as always, I want to encourage you to check out at acrossroads.net, and you will find bonus material, links to where you can find Ruth's books online, the Transforming Center that she has founded, links there, as well as the Transforming Community, which I will tell you more about as well. Also, please subscribe to the podcast, as you never know when another episode will appear, and you can do that via iTunes. Ruth is an author of, I'm not sure how many books, but a lot of them, and they're all good that I have read so far. She's won some really impressive awards as an author. Her book, Sacred Rhythms, won the Logos Book Award for Best Book on Spirituality. Her book, Invitation to Solitude and Silence, won the Christianity Today Book Award, and I am going to give her book, Strengthening the Soul of Your Leadership, the Noah Filipiak Book of the Year Award for 2015, probably for my whole life, actually. That's how I met Ruth, was via her book, if not really meeting her, but meeting her writing, via a friend of mine that gave me the book back in January of this year. I've probably given the book to at least a dozen people since then. For those of you that are regular listeners, this podcast is called Behind the Curtain, and it's because I've had a lot of issues in my ministry life. Lots of bouts with burnout, lots of bouts with self-striving, some subconscious motives to why I was doing ministry. Read a lot of books, and nothing, I wouldn't say nothing helped, but certain things helped a little bit. Nothing really, really helped until I read Ruth's book, Strengthening the Soul of Your Leadership. So, Ruth, welcome.
Thank you.
And thank you so much for allowing me to interview you.
Oh, it's wonderful. I'm very pleased.
So, in your book, Strengthening the Soul of Your Leadership, I know you talk about when you were on staff at a very large church, and you describe this visual of this whirling woman whose skirt is twisting around and hair is flying everywhere and trying to accomplish five things at once, barreling down the hallway, I think running into some staff member. I'm wondering if you can describe that for us, take us back to that day and what your life was like at that time, and if eventually you hit a something's got to give moment.
Well, actually, I had hit the something's got to give moment long before that.
Mm.
And the instructive thing about that is that it's possible to find your soul only to lose it again eventually. Mm. And so that's what we have to be vigilant about, right? Like, just because we found our souls once doesn't mean we're not going to lose it again.
Right.
So the first and most significant time was when I was in my early 30s and had been in ministry for about 10 years. And just came to a place where there were questions in my life that I didn't have answers for. There was a kind of drivenness that I wasn't sure how to name yet. I wouldn't have known to name it performance-oriented drivenness, but I knew I was driven. I knew that I was not able to choose a way of life that was good for me or my family or for my soul. And so that was the first time in my early 30s. And at that point, I dropped out of church completely, let go of everything, let go of every way in which I had identified myself as a Christian minister, and sought God for God's own sake, as opposed to what we often do, which is, you know, I think sometimes we hope we're going to have God in our back pocket and somehow he makes our ministries go well.
Yeah.
But that was a pivotal time, and dropped out for a couple years, actually, before coming back into ministry. So the time that you're mentioning, though, was after I'd come back from that, and I knew a little bit about the soul, and I knew a little bit about the things that drove me, and I knew a little bit about how important it was to keep your soul and to practice solitude in your life in ministry. But it just goes to show that it's easy to have learned it and still get away from it. So that particular day, I was running down the hallway trying to get to a staff meeting, and I had a sick child, so I was on the phone trying to check in with that sick child.
Yeah.
And it's a desperate, desperate feeling to wish, in a way, you were home with your child, but not be able to be there because you have something else you have to be doing. And I was determined not to get into that meeting without having checked on my daughter at home.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the situation. And I was, you know, director of spiritual formation at that time. And okay. So it was kind of embarrassing to be teaching other people how to live sane lives, but, you know, to have fallen back into it myself. So it was humbling to realize that there is no moment in our lives in ministry when we are safe from falling back into some of the old patterns that really don't work.
Yeah. In some ways, that's encouraging to me, because even as I'm in the early stages of this journey of learning these rhythms, I get discouraged because it's like I'm learning enough to know what it's supposed to be like, and I've tasted it, but I can't seem to grab it consistently.
Right,
so.
Right. But you know more now than you did. You know when you're out of it.
Yes.
And you now know what it feels like to be in rhythm and to be living connected with your soul and God in the midst of, in the depth of your being. So that when you get away from it, it's even more painful. You're aware of it quicker. I think that's encouraging, is that you're aware of it quicker. And because you have sacred rhythms in your life, you know how to get back to a place that's healthy. So it's still a good trajectory, even though there are fits and starts.
Yeah, definitely. The back cover of your book, Strengthening the Soul of Your Leadership, the big quote is, I'm tired of helping others enjoy God. And I think that's a very profound statement. I know it grabbed me when I saw it. Why do you think ministry leaders are so prone to feeling that way?
Mm-hmm. Well, because they are leaders.
Mm-hmm.
And when they discover something that's good for themselves, they very quickly get to a point where they want to share it with others. But what they don't realize is how quickly and how subtly we can get caught up in giving it to others, whatever that good thing is, like our connection with God. And pretty soon we're, you know, developing ministries and innovations and plans and trying to lead others, and we've gotten disconnected from the reality ourselves. So I think it's actually fundamental to the dynamic of leadership.
Mm.
Being a leader who wants to make a difference in the world is that we want to make a difference around these things that have meant so much to us, because we love God and we're grateful for what God has done for us. And when we find something, we want to share it. That's a part of leadership. But at the same time, it happens so quickly and so subtly that we get out of touch with the very thing that propelled us into ministry in the first place.
Right. Yeah. I know for me, as I've reflected on all these things, it's like I love God so much. Mm-hmm. I want to do so much ministry for Him.
Mm-hmm.
I end up doing so much ministry then that it's not that I don't love God, but I certainly don't love ministry anymore. Mm-hmm. And I really would just kind of like a break from all of it. And I'm at a very dangerous spot at that point.
Right,
It's a very... It's a very ironic cycle.
It is.
Yeah.
And if we could take it one step deeper, I would also say that many ministry leaders begin with extremely pure motives. You know, they love God, and they want to share their love of God with others. And they really do believe that because God has been good to them, that God is going to be good for others. But our ego stuff and our performance stuff gets hooked in really fast. And you start to realize, oh, wow, you know, you can get famous for doing this stuff. You can get people, you know, standing around you wanting to listen to you talk and thinking that you're the answer person. And it feeds us, you know. Mm-hmm. And then our culture, I mean, we live in a consumeristic culture generally, but we also live in a very consumeristic culture in the church right now.
Yes.
Where people are growing big churches, and we want to be that next church that's featured, you know, in Christianity Today or wherever such things get featured. And pretty soon we've got ego in it and we don't even realize it. And we're driven by a desire to perform and to succeed and to prove ourselves. We don't even realize that the motives are not quite as pure as they used to be. And it's a subtle, subtle slippage, I think.
Yes, I'm glad you brought that up, because that's the story of the last 10 years for me. You know, I started a church. I was very young. I mean, I was 23 when we launched.
Mm-hmm.
I'm 32 now. But the last 10 years, it's been this almost this new age in within the Christian market. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you look at how technology has exploded and the access we have to all these stories, I've heard it called before. I like this phrase. I didn't come up with it, but these church planter conferences, it's like church pornography in a way, where
it gets you all excited to do more and be more and stimulated.
Yeah, here's an unrealistic story of this person that started a church from scratch, but the first Sunday they had 10,000 people and now they're a celebrity. And if you don't do that too, then you're a failure.
Mm-hmm.
And I dealt with failure as a church planting pastor for, I'd say, most of my first, I don't know, 6 years at least. Mm-hmm. And that was till I got to a point of enough burnout that I had to go get some help, yeah. you know. Mm-hmm. But so with that, I think for me, you know, when I started my church, I had very pure motives. And my motives were, I want people to know Jesus.
Right.
I mean, I'm motivated by mm-hmm. people knowing Jesus. And I was a person of big faith. I was listening to sermons on having big faith and reading mm-hmm. books on big faith. And so in my mind, it made sense. If God can do anything, why would I want him to just save like one or two people mm-hmm. if he could save 1,000?
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, subconsciously underlying the surface, what came to light was our second weekend. At the time, we were on Saturday nights. Our second service, we had 18 people at mm-hmm. it. And I was under a church planting network and things like that. And 18 people was not how they drew it up
mm-hmm.
with the money they'd
mm-hmm.
given you and all those sorts of things. And it hit me really hard that my motivation actually hit me the hardest when the first person in our ministry accepted Christ. And I really wasn't even happy. I didn't really care because
mm-hmm.
we still only had like 20 people
mm-hmm.
per weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized, wow, I didn't really ever care about people coming to know Christ. I wanted a big church
mm-hmm.
because I'm insecure and I felt like this would, you know, make me look important, those sorts of things. So I'm wondering with that, you call it a Superman mindset
mm-hmm.
in some of your writing. I totally relate with that. What is the solution to doing ministry without having a Superman mindset? Because the temptation, honestly, is like, I'll just not do ministry.
Mm-hmm.
I'll just bail because I feel like I'm too prone to sin in this
mm-hmm.
way. And so I'm just going to like hang it up and, you know, go work a regular job or something.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Well, I do think that some of the answers to these dynamics do have to do with establishing those sacred rhythms in our lives that bring us back
mm-hmm.
to loving
Which
God.
Which I had no sacred
yeah.
rhythms back then
right.
whatsoever.
Yes.
Yeah. I did my devotions, so to speak, but it wasn't sacred.
No,
and
it's oftentimes about preparing the sermon at the same
yeah,
time as I'm trying to have devotions
yeah,
and stuff
yeah.
like that. But when we come to the end of ourselves and feel the emptiness of life lived the way that you're describing it, and we're drawn into sacred rhythms that keep us open to the presence of God and intimacy with God, and a desire for God's will above all else, it's real. I mean, we all say that. I mean, that's very spiritual sounding language. But
right.
when that really is true in our lives because of the intimacy of how we're living our lives with God, and we're confronting our false self stuff, which is what you're naming.
Yes.
And we're willing to let some of that stuff go, get burned away in the, you know, crucible of
yes.
of solitude. Then I think we can come to a place where loving God, being where God has for us to be, being with the people God has given us to be with, being faithful to God in every moment of our days, living our lives intimately with God becomes satisfying to the extent that the rest of it doesn't hold the same kind of allure that it used to.
Mm-hmm.
So that we're content to be with God in this small place, knowing that we're being faithful. We can somehow handle it if God explodes it into some huge growth. And, you know, Henry Nouwen points that out,
mm-hmm.
that once we've really dealt with our false self stuff, we can handle a great deal of success and
yes,
a great deal of failure.
Yeah.
And it doesn't affect our sense of self at all.
Yeah.
And I love that. And that comes through solitude, I will say. That ability
mm-hmm.
to have God established or reestablished as our ultimate orienting reality comes in and through the practice of solitude. It
mm-hmm.
does not come from anywhere else. It's you and God alone and that being enough. And then whatever happens on the outside is what it is, and you're with God, and in you know you're with God and in God, and
yeah.
that's your promised land, though.
Right.
The promised land is the presence of God, and you have that, and you're living a way of life that keeps you in that intimate space with God, and so the rest of it's gravy in a way.
Yes. Yeah. I know if our church had sort of grown to any even just a healthy state, I mean
mm-hmm.
even just 100 people or 150
mm-hmm.
people, 200 people. It would have wreaked havoc. It would have done horrible things to my soul
mm-hmm.
and to my ego where I was. I think the best thing that could have happened. In fact, there was a pastor. We're still good friends. He's in his 60s. We were using his church. And he's, I was 22 when I met him and told him about the church plant. And he said he's going to pray for me that our church, not that it failed like altogether, but he was going to pray that it did not grow.
Mm-hmm.
And because he had planted a church when he was about 22. And we still joke about that God answered his prayer and that God knew what he was doing, because I really could not have handled it.
Yeah.
It would have done bad things to me. So
yeah, it reminds me a little bit of James and John, you know, when they came into Jesus' presence and said, "What do you want me to do for you?" And Jesus said, "You have no idea what you're asking. Are you able to drink this cup?" I think we have visions for our success, and we have no idea the price that gets paid for that kind of success. Mm-hmm. We have no idea what's contained within that experience that could be detrimental or not. And Jesus is saying, you know, you don't know what you're asking when you ask for that. Are you able to drink this cup? And if he doesn't think we are, then, you know, praise him if he doesn't put us in a situation that our souls literally cannot handle.
Yeah. Yeah. One thing, this is sort of a question that I'm looking for help in my life, and I think it's something, I think you and I are wired somewhat similarly in that you're a driven person. I'm a very driven person, driven for ministry, driven for ministry leadership. And this idea of ambition, as I've been doing in some of our readings for our transforming community, and it's not the first time I've heard this or come across this. So I wrote a quote down from Dietrich Bonhoeffer's book, Life Together, which I really liked his book. I'd never read it before.
Oh, you hadn't? Oh.
Yeah, and I've owned it for years on my shelf, and I read it, you know, for our assignment, and I loved it. He's brilliant. So much good stuff in there. One little thing that kind of stuck me, though, that I don't know if I disagree or just need some help with. So this is him. It's on page 109. He's describing 1 Timothy 3, which is the qualifications of an elder. He calls a bishop. He says, one finds, let me make sure I'm getting the start right. One finds there nothing whatsoever with respect to worldly charm and the brilliant attributes of a spiritual personality. The bishop is the simple, faithful man, sound in faith and life, who rightly discharges his duties to the church. His authority lies in the exercise of his ministry and the man himself. There is nothing to admire. A little bit of backstory to this, too. Another great grace God gave me is I took a sabbatical 3 years ago, and I wrote a book, and I tried to get it published, and thankfully I didn't. Mm-hmm. It would have also been a very bad thing. Mm-hmm. I talk about this a little bit on the podcast. Mm-hmm. Fast forward 3 years, I rewrote the book. It's a book on identity in Christ and how that relates to sexual purity. It's a book for men. I got signed by an agent 2 weeks ago. It's exciting, those sorts of things. Things are moving along. But when I think about the 10 years of church planting and now 3 years of this sort of weird world of Christian publishing, which is like a whole nother conversation, I had a friend of mine who's another, just I very much respect him, it's a pastor who was counseling me, and he basically advised me to like stop blogging. You know, he said, I just don't think pastors should be blogging. I think like the big kind of the blogs that a lot of people read, that's great, but a lot, it's almost like if you're trying to blog, you're sinning, because he didn't say it that way, but it felt like if you're trying to blog, you're sinning because you're trying to be famous. You're trying to be a celebrity. You must have evil motives for it. Mm-hmm. If you're trying to write a book, if you're trying to get a book published, you must be sinning because you're trying to be famous. You're trying to like stroke your insecurity and your ego and all those sorts of things. And this, the Bonhoeffer thing just kind of hit me because I thought it feels like the only way to not sin as a pastor or as a bishop in his case is to just be as boring as you can be, and to be super dry, and to be as simple as possible, and just be sound, and do your duty, and make sure there's nothing to admire about yourself. Make sure you have no personality. And I've wrestled with that. I've wrestled with, you know, this theological truth that God has gifted each of us. Mm-hmm. But if we dwell on that too much, we're sinning. And so I guess I'm just wondering your advice, maybe to me specifically, you can't, or just kind of your thoughts on what Bonhoeffer brings up. I've really wrestled with it, and I don't really have a good answer at this point. So,
well, there's a couple things that come to mind. One is, I think that we glorify God by being the person that God has essentially created us to be. So to diminish oneself and be less than who God created to be, created us to be, could also be sinful, if you will.
Sure.
So I think I would be advocating for simply being the person that God has created you to be,
mm-hmm.
without grandiosity, without trying to put oneself forward, but to be that person, which means that you do have a personality, right? I mean,
right.
We each do have a personality,
right.
And we each do have gifts and callings too,
right.
You know. But it does take a great deal of wisdom to know whether certain ways of putting oneself out there are ego-aggrandizing or not.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know, the other thing that comes to mind that I would say to you as you're getting ready to put a book out there publicly is that my experience is that the things that I've written about are the places where I get most severely tested, so you better be ready for that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that in the very area where you're putting yourself out there.
Yeah.
So I hope you're ready for that.
Yeah. And a book on sexual purity is no joke.
No.
So.
So, yeah. You know...
Yeah.
I think that's what Jesus means when he says, are you able to drink this cup?
Yeah.
You know, it's one thing to get a book published. That feels kind of cool. But it's another thing to be challenged, really spiritually challenged, and be to be perhaps even more of a target for the evil one.
Right.
To want to take you down right there in that area that you're trying to champion something better.
Yeah.
So you'd want to be sure that you're ready for that and have the support for that.
Yeah. That's helpful.
Mm-hmm.
How did you get into writing? And nowadays, so I read a book. I don't want to say the name of it, but it basically was Here's How to Get Published,
mm-hmm.
right? And it was a Christian author. And I didn't have the terminology yet because I hadn't read your books, but it really could have been titled How to Build Your False Self.
Mm-hmm.
And then how to flaunt it,
mm-hmm.
and then that's how you get published. And I read that back in 2012,
mm-hmm.
right? And I did some stupid, embarrassing things that I've had to apologize to like people for. How have you navigated publishing, being more of a Christian subculture? Is weird. We have these little subcultures
mm-hmm.
and stuff, but I mean more of a known figure in mm-hmm. a sense. How have you navigated that while staying true to your true mm-hmm. self, I guess.
Well, people often come to me and want to ask me how I got into writing and will I help them, you know, and mentor them in writing. And
give them the book that I read.
Yeah,
if you need help.
And I always say no because I don't think that's my calling.
Yeah.
And because I didn't build it.
Right.
I was asked to write everything I've ever written.
Yeah.
And what I've written has emerged out of ministry. So the first thing I ever published was a little Bible study guide, you know, for women. And it came out of being asked in a church to prepare a set of Bible studies for a group that was meeting, which I did. And then after it was finished, you know, I thought, well, maybe someone would want to publish it. But it came out of
mm-hmm.
it came out of my desire to do something that was asked of me in a particular place in ministry. It came out in a really organic way. And so, you know, indeed, someone did want to publish it, and that's how the writing started. It was the same with the first magazine article that I published. Someone asked me to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And the first book I wrote, someone asked me to do it. It was the same publisher that I published Bible study guides with. They said, we think you have a book in you. Would you ever consider writing a book? I would have never I was 30 years old when that happened.
Yeah.
I would have never considered it. It was not in my mind to do. But they asked, and so I said, well, I'll give it a try. And so I think that one of the things that actually makes me feel confident about continuing to write is that it's been asked of me. It's not been something that I've been trying to seek and build. And that feels integrous to me. It feels like a solid place for me to stand. The other thing that I've done that's been, I think, a tremendously beneficial discipline is that I've not been an author who has used an agent to go out and try to get me bigger and bigger and better deals. I've established a relationship with a publisher.
I've noticed that.
That is full of integrity, and it's a real relationship.
Yeah.
Been working with them now for 15 years, and it's kind of like a marriage.
InterVarsity, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's kind of like a marriage.
Is that unique?
It is
to
unique.
Stay with one?
Absolutely, and people comment on it all the time.
Yeah.
We notice that you're, you know, a faithful author of one publisher, and that's intentional because I think the best things come out of real relationships, community, if you will. And I have a real relationship with my publisher and with the individuals that I work with, my editor and the marketing director and the president. And that's been a very good thing for me. It's been pure. It's been purifying, just like marriage is purifying.
Yeah.
You know, because if you stay with a marriage, you change and you become a better person for having stayed in that
right.
committed relationship. And a committed relationship can hold a whole lot more than a relationship that you're just going to leave whenever you feel like it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it means you can actually wrestle through things that are good for both. So
yeah.
It's what I've chosen to do, but it's been a good discipline for me to not always just allow my writing to be about the next biggest and better deal, or allow someone to take my work and
mm-hmm.
put it out there in ways that I wouldn't be proud of.
Yeah.
And I also have a lot of trust with my publisher now, and we have a lot of give and take back and forth, and
mm-hmm.
it's been a very, very good thing.
Yeah. You using the great title of this podcast, you pull back the curtain
mm-hmm.
a little bit and strengthening the soul of your leadership. When you talk about your board, you talk about some of the struggles you guys
mm-hmm.
have went through and founding the Transforming Center and then just even more recent struggles. But it sounds to me, just from reading those little snippets, that you and your board have a pretty close community amongst yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can you talk about that and how, I'm guessing that would help. So if so, how does that help you, I don't know, sort of stay grounded? I mean,
mm-hmm.
these are people you just have a relationship with and they're
mm-hmm.
doing this ministry with you. I think there's a lot of application there to church ministry for like pastors
Absolutely.
Listening to this or
mm-hmm.
even members of a church to really analyze, let's say, how a church's governance structure is set up. Because I think there's a lot of church governance structures that are set up really in unhealthy ways,
mm-hmm.
where there's, whether it's different hierarchies that are unhealthy
mm-hmm.
or different expectations that are unhealthy. So what's your experience like with that? And maybe how would you advise a church
mm-hmm.
To set up their structure in a way that's going to protect all their leaders,
mm-hmm.
but particularly their pastor
mm-hmm.
or pastors?
Well, one of the most important reasons why our board has been what it is because from the very beginning we set out to be a transforming community.
Yeah.
We didn't start out to lead transforming communities. We started
right.
out to be one.
Yeah.
And that means that we are governed by a covenant. We have
mm-hmm.
a covenant relationship
mm-hmm.
with each other. We have some, you know, really strong and clearly articulated commitments that make up that covenant.
Mm-hmm.
We are always wrestling with what it means to be a community who's living these things while we lead these things. And our relationships are long-term. That's one of the challenges I think that many boards and church elder groups have is the
right.
the turnover, the
yeah.
term limits and stuff like that. So I'm very willing to talk about that. I understand why there are term limits. I think it's to limit power and to make sure that there's a number of voices that get to speak. But one of the things that can get lost in that process is that there's not enough time together to actually cultivate community
right.
before people start rolling off and new people start coming on. There are ways to deal with that, which I talk about in other places, like in Pursuing God's Will Together. But I think the idea of the leadership understanding themselves to be a community that's gathered around the presence of Christ to be transformed in Christ's presence
mm.
so that they can discern and do the will of God, that is the commitment. And we gathered together first before we had a ministry vision at all to be a community gathered around the presence of Christ because we all wanted to experience deeper levels of spiritual transformation so that we could actually discern the will of God.
Mm.
And so part of my, I think one of my most important roles in the Transforming Center, we call me the CEO, but we really mean Chief Essence Officer
mm-hmm.
to make sure that
mm-hmm.
we are continuing to lead
yeah.
Out of the essence of who we are and that
yeah.
we're true to the essence of ourselves, which is to be a transforming community.
Right.
And that's my job all the time, is to make sure that we are living as who we say we are
mm-hmm.
and how we began.
Yeah.
And it's not easy all the time because mission, I think, always wants to overtake essence.
Yeah.
Always. Both in our individual lives and in our lives as a group.
Yeah.
And so
yeah.
There's a kind of vigilance that I feel like I need to bring
mm-hmm.
to that to make sure we're always working out of our relationships in community, gathered
mm-hmm.
around the presence of Christ for transformation
mm-hmm.
purposes.
How old is the Transforming Center, and how long have you been with the people
mm-hmm.
that you're on the board with now?
Well, we will be celebrating 15 years next year.
Great.
In 2016.
Yeah.
And you know, there's always some people who come and go.
Sure.
So some of our board members have been there from the beginning, and some of
That's
our
great.
Newer additions. We
yeah.
are actually seeking to expand the board right now
mm-hmm.
because the board's a little bit too small for the organization that we've
sure,
become.
Sure, as you've grown. Yeah.
Yeah. And then some of the most surprising people, like Daylene, the person that you just met,
mm-hmm.
she's been with me for almost all of those 15
cool.
years. Yeah.
That's awesome. Well, before I let you go, I want to get your thoughts on, this is just kind of a change of subject in a way, I want to get your thoughts on technology, because we talked about that a bit at the last retreat, and, you know, I'm 32, and technology truly is a blessing and a curse, and I think more curse than blessing, and I think that I've been wrestling with, you know, I have an iPhone, and so just for listeners, you know, at the first transforming community, we were told we had to unplug, and I was like, no big deal, like, whatever, and I turned everything off, my phone and stuff, and that first night, I could not fall asleep. Oh, and we had just gone to this big exercise about trusting God, all the things we were going to trust Him with. So I felt great. You know, I felt, oh, I really can trust God because I can't sleep. All I can think about, and it was stupid stuff, like wanting to check my email and my Facebook page and wanting to know, like you know, the world needs me so much. I woke up all throughout the night, and then I woke up for good at like 5 a.m. Like boom, could not fall back asleep. And it really was like a drug addict going through withdrawal. But I never even knew that I was so addicted. And so I think, and some people, frankly, have it worse than I do. I mean, I hardly watch television. I know people that watch like a streaming, you know, Netflix sort of thing. I mean, all the time. So what's happening to us? And what are the effects of it on spiritual formation? And is there any way in this world we live in, besides, you know, I don't say this sarcastically at all, but I look at like the Amish, you know, and I think, man, they might have it down, you know, like I think there's got to be some kind of middle ground in there, though. I mean, what kind of advice do you give to, let's say, those 40 and under that are in this just spiral?
Yeah. Well, I'm really glad you brought us back to that, because it's what I thought of when you talked about the pastor who thought you shouldn't blog. I don't think blogging is a sin, but I do think it really interrupts our spiritual lives. Because it keeps us on all the time and always connected. And what I see in the younger generation, and it makes all the sense in the world to me, is that it's almost like life isn't real unless you're blogging it or Instagramming it and getting the likes. And if you don't get the likes, then it's, you know, if you don't take a picture of it
photos
and put it out
everything.
There, did it actually happen? Does it have any meaning if I just kept it to myself? Would it be enough if I just kept this very precious moment to myself? So you're so right in bringing this issue up. And I do think that what it's doing to us spiritually, one of the things it's doing to us spiritually, is that it's making solitude and silence impossible. Is making it the kind of stress that you experienced on the last retreat. Because there was a time just one generation ago when there were all sorts of natural times for solitude built in, whether it was riding in the car, whether it was being on vacation, whether it was being out on a walk. There was no possibility of being on. So there were all these natural moments built in, and now every single moment has to be a radical choice if you want to be unplugged at all. I remember speaking on solitude and silence, and a person came up to me and said, you know what, you're talking about solitude and silence, but I'm a farmer. You know, and I'm out on the tractor by myself all the time. And so I have some of that in my life. And he was so right. In an agricultural culture, there was all sorts of time even built into our work when you're alone and you literally can't hear anything. You're on a tractor or on a lawnmower. And so I think young people, though, are rightly concerned about what's happening to us. So I think we all need to really pray about technology as a spiritual practice and ask God, what is the appropriate thing for me? Where are my temptations? Where, what are the things that I find taking me out of presence with other people and out of presence to God, out of solitude, out of being able to let go and, you know, just be in God's presence and then discipline ourselves. So I have some very concrete ones for myself. One is I have an iPhone, but I don't have email on it. Because I don't think I could live. I don't think I could stand having my email coming in to me all the time, whether I was on vacation or whether I'm on retreat. Like when I'm on retreat, I'm on retreat. But that's because I've set it up that way. I've chosen not to bring a computer. I've chosen not to have email on my phone because I want to be unplugged when I'm unplugged. And so I know some people who are off Facebook because they were young people who have gone off Facebook because they realize that it's a very narcissistic existence, and they're disciplining that part of themselves. So I think we need to think in those terms, what needs to be disciplined so that I can be more present to others, be more present to God. You know, little tiny things like I will not look at my phone when I'm with other people. Like it's in my purse. I do not have it on the table where I can see it. Those are small things. Solitude, you've got to really grapple with solitude. Are you willing to not have your cell phone with you and on when you're in solitude? Is it solitude if you have your phone right there and on? And what does that mean if we're willing to allow our time with God to be interrupted by whoever whoever texts us,
right,
as though that could be more important than this?
Yeah.
Wow. What about vacations? Do you really unplug on vacation? And do you set that expectation with your church and with the people around you? And do you set it up so they have another pastor they can find, someone else who's taking those duties so that you really can be unplugged, but your people don't have to suffer if there's a funeral or a hospital visit or something that's needed? I mean, this is the weeds. This is the deep weeds of spiritual practice now in a day and age when technology has encroached on absolutely every open space that there used to be.
That's very true. Very true. And those are profound words. And honestly, it's been one of the biggest things I've been praying through since our last retreat is what do I need to do?
Yeah. With technology specifically.
With technology, you know, and wrestling with that because I want to publish this book. And therefore, because Christian publishing industry for someone in my position says you must have this Facebook page and Twitter and these amount of followers. And so thank you for that. I mean, I think it's the type of prophetic words that just need to be spoken. Because we are in a new age, and it is very new. I'm 32.
And you've seen it change a lot just in the last 10 years.
Totally. I mean, when I was a kid, we didn't even have an answering machine.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know what I mean? Like, literally, think about going home, and if you don't answer the phone, well, I'll talk to him tomorrow.
That's right.
I mean, it's happened so quickly. But now, this generation of college students, they're probably the first generation that's never known a world
that. Mm-hmm.
They've only known this crazy world.
Right.
Like my 2-year-old and 3-year-old, they watch the iPad all the time.
Yes, and my generation is I've read this book called The End of Absence.
Hmm.
It's not a Christian book, but it's about this very dynamic that we are no longer able to be absent. You can't go anywhere and be absent from anywhere, whether it's vacation or whatever. And that my generation is the last generation who will know what it was like before technology as it exists today. This generation, when our generation dies, no one will remember. No, there'll be nobody on the planet who remembers what it was like before this.
Wow.
You know?
Wow.
So can I mention a spiritual discipline that could go along with this then?
Yeah.
Have you ever heard of the spiritual discipline of hiddenness?
I don't think so.
Well, it is a spiritual practice, and maybe you can imagine what that would mean. How is God calling me to be hidden sometimes? You know, to not have to put everything out there. Things about my relationship with God, or can some of those remain hidden? Or does every single thing that happens between us have to go out there in a blog?
Right.
What of my achievements am I willing to allow to remain hidden? You know, what acts of kindness am I willing to do and have them be hidden? So the discipline of hiddenness, I think, could be a very profound kind of discipline for people in this generation who are used to putting absolutely everything out there. And it would go, you know, then it would also confront the kind of narcissism that's coming along with the ability to put everything out there and to make ourselves the center of attention, you know, all the time.
I sense a new book you should write.
Oh, well.
Attack to the World of Technology, please.
Yeah.
Speaking of books, I want to wrap up with that. I did not do your books justice whatsoever when we began. I'm wondering, we've hit on a lot of topics in this interview, and for some people listening to this, you know, they've never read anything that you've written. And so how many books total have you written up to this point?
I think 7.
Okay.
Yeah.
So if possible, give us a quick synopsis of the 7, or at least your most recent several that you want to talk about, because each of them is unique. And so give that to us, and I'll make sure on when I post this on my blog that I'm trying to not be sinful with having, I will give those synopsis as well. So kind of give us a quick pitch for each book, if you're able to.
I'll do the ones that relate most with the conversation we've been having. I'll just do that.
Yeah.
So Sacred Rhythms, which you've mentioned, that's really the people, when they ask me, where do I start with your books? I say, start with Sacred Rhythms, because Sacred Rhythms helps you to get in touch with your spiritual desire and then to begin to be introduced to some of the spiritual practices that correspond to our spiritual desires. So it's basic, but it's not an ought to, you ought to do this, you should do this. It actually helps you to get in touch with your deepest spiritual desires and to move from there into some rhythms that are good for your soul. And it moves through solitude, silence, prayer, encountering God in Scripture, honoring the body as a spiritual practice, mm-hmm. Sabbath keeping, discernment, and then establishing a rule of life or a set of sacred rhythms that help us to keep open and available to the presence of God. So that's where I'd have you start. If you're really feeling drawn to solitude and silence and also challenged by it, there's one chapter on solitude and silence and sacred rhythms, but Invitation to Solitude and Silence mm-hmm. is the one you'd want to go to next if you're feeling drawn to solitude and silence. And in that book, I really try to function as a spiritual director. It's not like there aren't a lot of other books about solitude and silence, but what I tried to do with that one was I had such a good spiritual director when I was entering into solitude and silence that I thought, not everybody has a spiritual director. Mm-hmm. So I want this book to be me acting like a spiritual director. Let me take you by the hand. Let's walk into this together. It's an extremely personal book as well. It tells a lot of my own journey from the place that you identified of being, you know, driven and out of control and untransformed and all that, and how God invited me in and what happened in my own journey. So you'll hopefully feel companioned by that book. Then I went to Strengthen the Soul of Your Leadership because I wanted to connect the dots between solitude and leadership. Because I felt like in the Christian community there was starting to be a false bifurcation set up between solitude and action, and that people were starting to say, oh, those contemplative types are the ones who practice solitude and silence, and I want to say, no, solitude is the very key discipline for all of us who are in Christian ministry. How do we connect the dots between solitude and leadership? So that's what Strengthening the Soul of Your Leadership is about. How do I connect my private spiritual disciplines with my public life as a leader? And that was it. Connecting those two dots was really important to me and still is. Then there are a couple chapters in that book on corporate leadership discernment as a spiritual practice. And I realized that really a lot of leaders out there these days have had no preparation at all for discerning God's will together at the leadership level. Mm-hmm. And there was so much interest in those two chapters that I realized I needed to write a whole book that was, let's step-by-step talk about how a leadership group can become a community that's able to discern and do the will of God. And then most recently, Life Together in Christ, Experiencing Transformation in Community, is now much more about the communal aspects of transformation. Oftentimes, spiritual formation gets reduced to just the solitude disciplines, the solitary ones. But formation happens in a set of concentric circles, solitude, community, and ministry in the church and in the world. So now moving from that solitary place, how do we open up to the process of transformation in community? And what is the role of community in our transformation process? And it's based on the Emmaus Road story and how the two disciples who were traveling the road between the now and the not yet encountered Jesus and how they were transformed because they were together, talking about all these things, choosing to take the journey together. Mm.
And I'm not done with that one yet. I'm reading it in pace with sort of our assignments, but I'm really liking it because I'm one of those people that's really kind of burnt out on church small groups to the point that I don't really go anymore, even though I'm a pastor and we promote them at our church. And it's filling me with hope that you can still, you know, have Christian community in a church in a way that's really impactful. But this conversation, I think a good way to close it is by another one of my faith heroes who you mention in at least one of your books, but Gary Haugen. I know he's the president of the International Justice Mission. He does, which is just does amazing work with fighting sex trafficking. And I heard him speak at the Justice Conference a few years ago about prayer. And I know they make your book mandatory for their staff of the Invitation to Solitude and Silence. And he said a quote I'll never forget, and it was that about they pray every day at this huge ministry with lawyers and all kinds of stuff to do, and they all break to pray. And he says, we do not pray out of discipline. We pray out of desperation. And that word desperation is a word you use as well. It's a word that brought me here. It's why I'm here. I'm desperate to know God and not just go through the motions. I know many others that feel the same thing. And so I would say that at this point in our history, we need spiritual practices and sacred rhythms more than any other time in history because we're being just drowning in the technology and in the
sheer pace of life.
Mm-hmm. Whether you're a pastor or not, whether you have, you know, just having kids, you know, just whatever it might be, these resources are so needed. And so thank you for putting yourself out there and being so transparent and for using the gifts God's given you. But I just can't recommend enough these books for people to read. I also want to point people towards, it's thetransformingcenter.org, and we'll have that. The is in the URL, T-H-E.
Doesn't have to be, though.
You'll
get there either way, perfect. Whether it's Transforming Center or The Transforming Center.
Wonderful. Mm-hmm. Yahoo has it in there, so
yeah.
There it is. Mm-hmm. Good to know that. Mm-hmm. And I'll link that on the website as well. And I'll say this, too. I'm in a transforming community, and I would encourage people that are getting into this stuff to check it out. It's well worth the money. I sort of thought of it as like just paying for a class at college or seminary. Very, very transformative. And so you can check out more information on that at thetransformingcenter.org as well. And so, Ruth, thank you so much. I will reference this interview many times in future interviews. So I don't know what to say, but thank you. Is there anything you want to say as a closing remark to people listening?
I like your comments about desperation. I think we should stop there. I think that oftentimes we're afraid to acknowledge how desperate we feel, especially if we're in positions of Christian leadership, and it takes a whole lot of courage to say, as a person in leadership, I am desperate for God. And actually, I think desperation is just desire that we've allowed to deepen to that place of desperation where we say, I'm willing to sell everything I have, like the merchant who finds the pearl in the field and knows, I've been looking for this all my life. I will sell everything I have in order to buy this field that has the pearl in it. I think that that's where desperation takes us spiritually. If we can acknowledge it and be courageous enough to face into it, eventually we're going to find the pearl. Our desperation will lead us there, and we'll sell everything we have. We'll be willing to rearrange our lives for what it is we say we really want. And that's the best way to get. It's the only way to get there in a way that will be sustaining.
Yes, it is.
Oughts and shoulds and momentary inspirations, right. They don't get us anywhere long term. But if you stay in touch with your desire and your desperation for God, rather than being afraid of it and ashamed of it, that will take you where you need to go spiritually. Even as a person in ministry, as uncomfortable as it is, go there and trust God to meet you there and lead you into the sacred rhythms that will give you life.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. This concludes this episode of the Behind the Curtain Ministry podcast. Check out at acrossroads.net for all the bonus materials from today's episode. Until next time, I will see you behind the curtain and at a crossroads.